And hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, May 27th, 2015. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are novelist Noreen Ayers and author Terry Messier. First up is Noreen Ayers. Noreen's fiction and poetry has won her top-tier awards in national contests and recognition by the Mystery Writers of America. Her mystery series features a civilian forensic specialist whose first name, Smokey, came from a stint in Las Vegas as an exotic dancer while the character was in her teens. Noreen holds an MA degree in literature from Cal State University at Los Angeles and has taught composition and creative writing at community colleges. Today, she lives in the northeast of Pennsylvania, actually, with seven rescue cats and a husband who keeps her laughing at his thrice-told miserable joke, she says. She's here primarily to talk about a story she has in the new anthology, Manhattan Mayhem, published by Quirk Books on June 2nd, and The Juan Doe Murders, published by Brash Books, available right now. Here she is, Noreen.
Hello, hi, Dad. I'm so happy to be here.
I'm so happy to have you here. Well, as you know, it's a tradition on this show to begin with the author telling our listeners about his or about how his or her book came about. Talk about the genesis. Let's first talk about the Juan Doe Murders. Talk about that book and how it came about.
All right. The Juan Doe Murders came about because I used to drive the freeways in Orange County, California, where there were vast fields of migrant workers. These are men and women and sometimes children who worked the rows of strawberries, corn, or bell peppers. I was touched by that because overhead might be a jet coming into the Orange County Airport, and beyond that, the skyline of tall buildings, and yet this agriculture was still going on. Also, there are communities in Orange County that are primarily made up of Hispanic folk who come to work and find a better life in our country. And some of them are abused and murdered, as we know. So that's how the Juan Doe Murders came about. The title is Take Off on the John Does. Mm-hmm. And in the morgue there in Orange County, they sometimes would refer to them as Juan Does.
Hmm. You know, I mean, we've known each other such a long time, and I, from the start, have loved your writing and the tone and style, I think, of your writing. And, you know, I think readers and other writers are always interested in how authors develop a style. And I was just thinking about this and wondering if you consider yourself a stylist who writes in the mystery genre, or how you identify yourself.
Bless your heart. I love that. Yes. I'd love to be considered a stylist. That might not mean that mainstream readers are going to grab onto that and eagerly seek my next book, to be frank. However, if it's done correctly, maybe not by me, but by someone, that hook will be there no matter the level of readers. And I mean the readers who might want to consume a book in one night, and there are those out there, or the ones who look more for the poetry of our language. And speaking of that, please interrupt me, by the way, Barbara, if I go on too long. Speaking of that, I try to start each book with a hook. That's probably something that every writing teacher is going to tell students. And the hook is stylized. In this book, I won't read the first paragraph because it's too gory, but I'd like to read the first two sentences to tell you what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Okay. From chapter one. I'd say the girl was 17. I'd say she had been pretty.
Yeah.
That's actually the first paragraph. If anyone has followed the series, this is the third in the series featuring, as you said, a forensics investigator. And they see such dreadful things. Later in the book, I have some scenes taking place in Orange County that are not that relevant to murder, but I hope they bring about a sense of place, which I enjoy when I'm reading.
Well, yeah, and just in terms of something you said a little bit ago about poetry, you've also published poetry, and I was curious about that. If you talk about how poetry has perhaps helped you to develop a style, or has it?
Yes. Yeah, thanks. I love this quote by Faulkner that he said he wrote novels because he couldn't write stories, short stories. He wrote short stories because he couldn't write poetry. Well, as a student of literature, I've read all three things from him, and, you know, the guy didn't do bad for himself, right? Nobel winner. and his fiction is poetic, too. But sure, I think the training in poetry made me conscious of sound. Free verse took over the 20th century poetry, and so we don't rhyme so much. We do have what's called off rhyme, and we like sounds that are euphonious but also sound alike sometimes. Instead of rhyming slant with can't, we might say slant and cast. So anyway, I'm conscious of that. And I want to bring pictures to people. Therefore, the metaphors, the similes that we find in poetry help us see little pictures. And so when I'm writing, I'm conscious of that.
Noreen, will you read a little bit more to us from the Huando murders?
Okay. And again, I'm trying to avoid the gory. I am a moody type of person, kind of sad. If you met me, you'd never know that, because I smile a lot. I'd like to think I'm kind to people, pat them on the head and all that. But my nature in trying to find a philosophy of life is a little melancholy, and I might bring that to my books. So in order to relieve that, there's only one writer I know who can sustain that melancholy mood all the way through his work, and that's Thomas H. Cook, C-O-O-K, if you're seeking that. Mm-hmm. In order to relieve that, I wrote about the character Smokey Brandon going into a section on South Orange County and helping the Audubon Society members clear out an invasive species of cane, of bamboo. And so I could read a few paragraphs of that, if that's all right.
That'd be great.
Okay. She grabs up some pruners instead of a machete because she's afraid she's going to cut her own ankle off if she used the machete like a lot of the other people were doing. And then she says, I walk down a shaded gully to a fortress of cane near an electrical tower and lean my head against a stump hollowed by decay. Inside, a bug turned frantically on a tiny lake of captured water. The cane stalks were gray at the base from mud splash. I knelt and worked the blades of my pruners into a pack so tight I had to make two cuts before I could yank the first stalks out. For 2 hours, I cut, pulled, and manhandled cane. At times, I'd think of my recent cases, but tried to shunt it aside, knowing the mind needs rest so the pieces of puzzle can come vibrating home like shavings compelled to cleave to a magnet. After a particularly strenuous fight with a stubborn stalk, I drop my pruners and search for my thermos, now buried in a fan of green leaves. I pulled it free, then glanced at the tiny bug still churning in the stump water, slipped off my dirt-heavy glove, and dipped my finger into the lake to lift out a bit of struggling life. Wiping the creature onto the edge of the stump, I said, "Second chance, bub."
So that's
what I meant about giving us pictures, the tiny little bug she was going to rescue, and she's surrounding her with nature. And she does that quite a bit. She's a bird watcher. I'm keenly interested in your second guest on this show. I hope I'm not giving anything away by saying, you know, his book is about hummingbird rescue. So really interested in that.
Yeah, me too.
And I think people who are cops and forensics people, investigators, it's so easy to get disheartened and jaded. And so they exercise humor a lot, dark humor. And then they must do other things like, you know, do physical things, sports perhaps, or watch their kids screaming at games, or get out in the nature and birdwatch or cut invasive species.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, Smokey, how much of Smokey Brandon is you?
A lot of Smokey Brandon is me, not her biography. I was never an exotic dancer, as they called it. I never knew they called it exotic dancers until I was in Las Vegas and I was looking in the phone book for something and I saw this whole category, exotic dancers. Oh, wow. So I made her an exotic dancer early, like from age 17 to 19. And the reason I did that is I left home at 17. I had an alcoholic mother. Guess what? Smokey Brandon has an alcoholic mother. And so she was just knocking about and took that job for a while. And it may seem odd and brazen to have someone who is in a professional job later in life having been a stripper. But it happens. In fact, there was a famous person in Orange County who had been a stripper, and then she became a cop.
Hmm. Well,
so yeah, I'd say a lot of the thoughts, the moods, are me. Interestingly enough, one fan wrote me after my first book came out, and for some reason, she focused on a scene I wrote where a woman pulls out, in fact, Smokey, pulls out a Kotex pad. Golly, we don't even use those anymore, I don't think. And hands it to some other girl on the beach to cover a wound, a slice that the person got from a shell or a bottle. So this fan said, a reader, I should say, said, "That's got to be something that happened in real life." No. But there are other things in my book that are, especially the experience of being around the Las Vegas area, because my parents lived up around there.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm with Noreen Ayers, and we're talking about the Huando murders, published by Brash Books. Well, a couple of things. I want you to just talk a little bit about how your mystery writing career actually began. And I know you were writing fiction long before you went to Squaw Valley, but there you met an editor, and everything proceeded from that. Can you say a little bit about that? Because, you know, writers are always wondering, how am I going to find an agent? How am I going to find an editor? Mm-hmm. How's it going to happen? Will it ever happen?
Yeah. I'm eager to talk about that because one thing about me is I love to encourage people. Now, at the same time I can tell you a recipe, a regimen for what you should do, like going to conferences, I also know that a lot of publication success comes about through networking with people, but also sheer luck. The right thing at the right time, catching the right editor's eye. I did go to Squaw Valley with 30 pages. That's all you were able to bring. I didn't even have the book fully complete. I had 100 pages. And for some reason, it just captured the interest of the editor who eventually bought the book, but also an agent and a film producer, all three of whom happened to be residing in the same house there at the conference. Mm. And so, the editor mentioned this reading that he heard in the workshop, and then the agent was interested, and then the movie producer. So, yes, and then I went on to get a contract. It went to auction, and I sold the book for low six figures. Again, the only reason I bring that up is I want to hearten people. Not that they should aspire for that or more. There have been recent advances that are $1 million. But to say that door might open if you put yourself in the path of the door.
Right.
So go to conferences, go to workshops. I think local workshops are terrifically valuable, like your own, I might say, friend, where you get feedback and you learn from hearing people critique other people's work, too. So that's how it got started, and I just feel very, very grateful for that.
Yeah.
And then the series came about, and then there was this long hiatus where I could not get another book out for personal reasons, life reasons. And then my present publisher volunteered to bring the series back, and that's Brash Books.
That's great.
And, so the Wando Murders is available through Brash Books, which is headed up by a wonderful partnership of two brilliant writers itself. They respect writers, and they wanted to bring their books back. So it's in digital form as well as print.
Yeah, and Lee Goldberg is one of the writers I know that heads up Brash. And he's a TV writer, too, I believe, yeah?
Yes, he wrote... I hope I don't misname the shows, but he was head writer for Monk, Diagnosis Murder,
yes,
for a long time, and then he produced books based on those two shows. All the popular shows back in the 90s and 2000s, he had a hand in.
Hmm.
And he's funny and kind and generous and got a great smile. And his partner is a brilliant writer, too. I had not heard of Joel Goldman before, but he's got three series out, too.
Hmm.
And they do a lot of promotion for the authors.
Yeah, yeah. So the mystery genre, you don't find many, many literary writers who publish poetry who are poets who also write mystery. I think Stephen Dobbins is the only other one that comes to mind. There may be more, but... So talk about the mystery genre and whether you found it or it found you and how that happened.
Wow, simultaneous discovery. I spoke about workshops and the gratitude I have from that. I knew, I had been a technical publications worker in corporations, and I was, but I'd always had this urge to write. And I thought, well, what could I write that is me and might allow me to leave the workplace? And then in that workshop, I heard samples from each category, each genre, science fiction, romance, historical, and so on. And I thought, well, mystery is more like me. That's how I found it. But speaking of... poetry and mystery, one of the first poems I had published dealt with a murder where the whole wall was taken out of a home to show the blood spatter. And I read about that in the Orange County newspaper. And so that's one of the poems. I did win 2010 Writer's Digest first prize for a poem that I had written 30 years before and had never sent anywhere. Again.
Why? I don't even remember this. Why didn't you ever tell me this?
Again, you know, take that stuff out of your drawers and try it again if you love it.
Yeah.
If you love it, don't give up. And there's so many reasons to be discouraged. Good heavens. But walk in a bookstore and see all those volumes there.
Yeah.
And it could be you.
Yeah. They don't just appear. Somebody sat for a while and wrote them. And I think writers, especially new writers, feel that somehow you're hatched as a published author or something, you know, that it could never happen to them. But yeah,
yes.
You got to stay in the chair. That's sometimes the sad thing.
Stay in the chair. I love that. Yeah, got to stay in the chair. And, you know, it's such a solitary endeavor. We need quiet. We need lack of distraction. And people don't understand, people who are not writers, they don't understand that intense need to get the words on the page. But you just have to ignore their lack of understanding and keep at it if you love it. And, you know, the best advice, I heard this great advice from the brilliant Richard Ford at Squaw Valley. The first time I ever went to Squaw Valley was because of him, because of a short story I read by him. And I thought, wow. And he's a literary writer. A student raised his hand and said, how long does it take to get published? And he said, 20 years. And then another student raised his hand and said, how do you know if you should stop? And here's the brilliant piece of advice. He said, if you can, do. If you can stop, do. And the reason he said that, of course, is just what I was talking about. So many sacrifices. And so, you know, if you want to pick up a guitar instead, go do that.
So true. That's great advice. And that's a great way to close out the show because we are at the end of our time. But I wish we had... we had decided on an hour, so you're going to have to come back again, of course. But I wonder if you could give your website and tell people how to find you on Facebook and that sort of thing.
Oh, all right. My website is my two names joined together.com. So where people might mess up is my last name, Ayres, is the Scottish spelling. It's A-Y-R-E-S. So it's N-O-R-E-E-N. AYRES.com. And Facebook, the same name, Noreen Ayres.
Well, it's been wondrous to talk to you on the radio, my dear, and we shall talk more. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I love talking to you. I love your questions.
Oh, and I love you, Noreen. I'll talk to you later. That was Noreen Ayres. Her books are The Juan Doe Murders, published by Brash Books. You can find them online. And also the short story collection, which we had no time to really talk about, is called Manhattan Mayhem. She has a story in here along with Thomas H. Cook, whom she mentioned, T. Jefferson Parker, Lee Child, and more. And it's edited by and features an original story by Mary Higgins Clark, published by Quirk Books. That's all the time for the first half of the show, but we're going to be back with the Hummingbird Rescuer in the second half, hopefully. And so stay with us. We shall be right here.
This is a man's world. This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl. You see, man made the cars to take us over the road. to carry the heavy load. Man makes the electric lights to take us out of the dark. Man made the boat for the water, like Noah made the ark. This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl. Now listen. Man thinks about little bitty baby girls and baby boys. Man makes them happy, 'cause man, he makes them toys. And after man has made everything, everything, everything he can, you know that man makes money to buy from other men. But this is a man, a man's world. Not a woman or a girl. Now I said he's lost, lost in the world of a man. Oh yeah. And he's lost, lost in bitterness. Nothing without a woman or a girl. This is a man's world. This is a man. This is a man's world. I know and you know this is a man's world. This is a man's world. But it wouldn't nothing, nothing without a woman or a girl. Bring some loving here today. the answer. For only love can conquer hate. And you know, we got to find a way, oh, to bring some loving here today. Picket lines, and there's picket signs, and don't punish me with brutality. Hey, talk to me so you can see all what's going on.
Hello again, and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and the first half of the show we were with Noreen Ayers. Her book is The Juan Doe Murders, her first novel, which was wonderful, A World the Color of Salt. Love that book. And she also has a short story in Manhattan Mayhem. But we are back with our next guest, the hummingbird rescuer. Terry Messier has been teaching English as a second language at UCLA's Extension American Language Center since 1994. For the past 8 years, she's devoted much of her time to rescuing and learning about hummingbirds. Terry and her network of colleagues in Southern California rehabilitate over 500 orphaned and injured hummingbirds each year and refer hundreds more to wildlife centers and humane societies around Southern California. And today we're going to focus on her new book, Fastest Things on Wings, Rescuing Hummingbirds in Hollywood, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Hi, Terry.
Good morning, Barbara. How are you?
Great. Great to have you on the show. Let's begin by talking about The Fastest Things on Wings and how this book came about.
The book has been in process for several years. I just had the idea a few years ago, but the events of the book take place in 2008, and it became increasingly important to write this book as we were doing rescue over the last 10 years because there's so much misinformation out there. So part of the reason for the book was to educate the public, but also to tell a very fun and exciting story about hummingbirds.
Well, I love hummingbirds. We have a hummingbird nest on our property that we haven't had any families in it this season, but we have in the past. I don't know why they're not in it now. Maybe you know, but I, you know, it's, they're magical creatures. And so when this book came through a few months ago, I think that minute that I took the wrapping off, I got in touch with your publicist and said, I must talk to her.
Yeah, it's they are magical, and they really capture the human imagination. But even more than that, they capture people's hearts. And when people get involved with hummingbirds, it transforms their world in unbelievable ways. And you can talk to them years later, and they'll tell you a story, something that happened to them 20 years ago with a hummingbird. And you just think, wow, are you really remember that well? But everybody, it makes an incredible impact on people when they get involved with these little creatures because they are so captivating and compelling. So
how did you become a hummingbird rescuer? You go into it a bit in the book, but it'd be nice to give our listeners a taste of that.
Yeah, my Abyssinian cat escaped from the house one morning and brought a baby home and set it on the floor in the living room, and it was undamaged. I have no idea where he got it. He wouldn't say. And he, so I took the baby to Gene Roper, who was at the time, most well-known hummingbird rehabber in the Los Angeles and Southern California area, if not the world. And then a couple years later, I had another bird get washed out of a nest in a storm, and the next time I went back to her, she got her hooks in me. Because her property was buzzing with 50-some rescued birds at the time, and I was just enthralled and thought, wow, this is an incredible thing to do with your spare time, but I had no idea what I was getting myself into. So,
so what did you get yourself into? I mean, you...
I don't even know how to tell you, Barbara, how to explain how it changes your life. But I You know, I began rescuing birds in 2006. I did about 20 or 30 birds, and by 2008, I was doing over 200 a year. Each one stays in rescue for 6 to 8 weeks, and they go through a series of stages of rehabilitation that's a kind of a military-type setup where, you know, everybody passes through the same educational process, and by the time they go, they're as strong and healthy as possible. So we are overwhelmed as well with phone calls, of which I get about 2,000 a year.
Hmm. So let's talk about the actual physical aspect of the book and the book coming about. Did it begin with a book proposal, or how did once you had the idea for the book, what happened next?
Actually, I was trying to get another book published, and everybody, the publishers kept saying, oh, by the way, I heard you do hummingbirds. My agent kept telling people that I was a hummingbird rehabber. Every publisher kept saying, and so I wrote up a proposal, and the trade publications, the trade houses were all like, we love this, but we want, you know, more. So I wrote half of the book, and my agent submitted it to a couple of houses, and they said, we want the whole book, which has become a common thing nowadays for writers, and it has its up and its downside. And on the one hand, you get the whole book written. On the other hand, you're putting in a lot of time for something that's a big bet. You know, you're betting it all. So I did. So I sent me home and said, write the whole thing, finish it. It took about a year, and when I got it done, it got, you know, out and bought it in 3 days.
You obviously, you had an agent before you wrote this book. So did you get an agent for the other book that you were hoping to sell? Is that what happened?
The other book is about cats, interestingly. I know it's an odd combination. I wrote my first book about cats and, got a lot of positive response over and over. Everybody said, I love it, but no thanks. And I went through that many, many times. So, and they kept asking me about the hummingbird story. Is there anything you can write about that? So the agent had been, my agent, Felicia F., had been out, you know, trying to sell the cat book for like a year when I started writing the hummingbird book.
Might that come out now that this is out?
Oh, I can only dream, Barbara. That's my greatest hope, that someone will pick up the cat book. It's, you know, it's a lively, fun story, too, and it's universally loved. That's a funny thing about the publishing business. Everybody wrote these glowing rejections, and so I didn't know where to go, and neither did my agent. She just kept saying, we'll just keep submitting it, but we kind of finally ran out of options, so she said, write this book, and then we, got this, sold immediately. So we're hoping that if this gets some traction, that maybe someone will pick up the other book. You never know.
You never know. That's right. You never know. I am talking with Terry Messier. Her book is Fastest Things on Wings, Rescuing Hummingbirds in Hollywood. And it's published, I think, June 2nd, but it is, you can pre-order it everywhere right now. And it is a print book, and publication date actually June 16th, it says on the back. So it's a wonderful, wonderful book about hummingbirds and her rescue activities and about hummingbirds themselves. So, hummingbirds are one of those creatures that it's hard to understand in some way why they really lasso your psyche and kind of keep you interested. I mean, we have, I think, 4 feeders on our property, and I just love it when I see them. I don't know, I don't know why exactly, but can you talk a little bit about them, about sort of the magic that they spin?
Yeah, well, they're different from every other bird on the planet. For one thing, they weigh less than a nickel, and that's hard to imagine. They used to weigh less than a penny until they stopped making pennies with copper. Now they weigh less than a nickel, but, to imagine a bird being that small, and then their flight skills are unsurpassed. They can flip, spin,
do fly forward, backward, barrel roll, do straight verticals. And their wings move from anywhere from 60 to 120 times per second. So you can't wrap your mind around that either. It's pretty much science fiction. And then there are a couple of species that fly. The ruby-throated flies all night over the Gulf of Mexico when it migrates. It flies, makes a 15-hour nonstop flight. And the rufous flies 7,000 miles a year from Central America to Alaska and back. And these birds are so tiny, it's just mind-boggling to imagine them making these epic journeys every year. And then the fact that when you do see a hummingbird, as you said, you can't take your eyes off of them. There's just that magical flight. It's just something that it's just so stunning and compelling. You're unable to not watch them, and I guess that's why they grab people.
Hmm. So when they migrate, do they make the same stops? I mean, can you know, every so often my husband thinks he recognizes a hummingbird that was here last year. And
Yeah, they do. There's actually a chapter in the book about that. They not only make the same stops, they go to the same feeders on these 3,000-mile journeys north. They'll stop at the same feeder every year, and the reason we know that is that banders have trapped them at the same feeders on the same day, year after year.
Wow.
So there's some kind of fantastical program in that tiny brain that's the size of a BB.
Yeah.
How they can have that much information stored in there is just beyond belief.
Hmm. So. Well, computers do it.
Exactly. They are the ultimate microchips, these little birds, and they can... what they can do... it's so far beyond what we could do, and it's so interesting. If you take your feeders and hang them on a longer wire, after they've visited 1 year, they'll come back the next year and they'll hover at the higher space first, and then when they see the longer wire, they'll go down to the feeder. But initially, they go right back to where the feeder was the first time.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. And they're also, I've noticed, really territorial, or can be.
Oh, yeah. They are, you know, they're dinosaurs. You've got to keep that in mind. There are a lot of new theories that they have evolved from the giant theropods that were once 600-pound dinosaurs that walked the earth, or ran the earth, as it were. And they are, you know, for all of their evolution and their downsizing over the millions of years, they've retained that attitude that they rule the world. So they are territorial because they think they're still in charge. And in a sense, they are, because they've carved out a niche between insects and birds that nobody else can inhabit. So they are territorial. They're the meanest birds out there. Even as I say that, some of them are incredibly sweet, and it's dependent on the species and gender even more than the individual bird. So,
What about attracting hummingbirds to your property? Can you actually do things to cause them to want to be at your place, to hang around your home, your flowers, your feeders?
Yeah, I mean, feeders, of course, are a no-brainer, because hummingbirds, they all know feeders. We have so many feeders now in the country, and they're very accustomed to making their migratory flights, you know, with feeders, and so they look for feeders. Of course, there are books you can buy that give you the kinds of flowers you should plant and all that, and they like that. But the feeders are an easy way to attract them. The main thing is to keep them clean, because it's, you know, very important that they don't drink from dirty feeders. But they're pretty well educated now, and we have in fact expanded certain species like the Anna's range up to Alaska now because of the sheer number of feeders that people hang out. So, and the introduced vegetation. So we have actually expanded the territories of a lot of species, and that's one reason there's so many in Southern California. we have more hummingbirds than any city on Earth. I'm convinced of that. And the reason is people are obsessed with attracting them, and there are just feeders everywhere you look. So,
Interesting. We're getting down to the end of our time. Are there any hummingbird stories that come to mind that you'd like to talk about that may or may not be in the book?
Yeah, there are some terrific stories about individual personalities in the book, and to me that's the most fascinating thing about the birds. Each one has a different personality, just like domestic pets. And there are the two main characters in the book, Gabriel and Pepper, really were astonishing birds. And I would just encourage listeners to read the book to learn the amazing things that happened with these birds. But there are other minor characters in the book that are just as fascinating, you know, who made some incredible migratory flights and came right back to my patio and, you know, the next year and said hello. And so there are a lot of different colorful personalities, and it would take too long to describe all the things they did. So
how do they do that, though? Make that, you know, as you said, fly over the Gulf and not feed. How do they do that?
Well, you know, that's one of the big mysteries of ruby-throated hummingbirds. They think they leave it at dusk and fly all night, and they're guided by some kind of internal. Well, they may use the moon and stars, or they may use some kind of magnetic field. We just don't know, but it's phenomenal that they can. They bulk up before they leave, before they depart the coast. They double their weight, and then they fly all night, and they burn all that weight off. By the time they arrive in Mexico, they're essentially back to a normal weight. So they burn it off in that 17-hour flight. We don't know how they do it. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yes, it's and a lot of things they do are crazy, which is why I wrote the book, because I think so many people love hummingbirds, and the book just really brings it home just how special and unique they really are.
Was there anything you had to leave out? Did you write too much and you had to discard some of what you originally had in the book?
You know, I didn't. For some reason, I went on a tear when I wrote this book. And, you know, I know writers all have different approaches to writing. And my first book took me 2 years to write, and it was laborious, and I just slogged through it. And this one, I was just somehow, the muse was there, and I was on a roll, and I ran straight through it and wrote the first draft in about 2 or 3 months. And I don't write like that. I'm a much more, you know, determined writer who goes back and adds and takes out and, you know, like you said. But this was just a straight shot, and I never removed a thing. So,
interesting.
Yeah.
Do you read while you write? Were you reading novels or other nonfiction books?
You know, I try not to, because I'm a terrible thief. And I think all writers are terrible thieves. And if you can get away with it, it's great. But I don't trust myself to not steal things. When I read something really great, I'm like, oh, I want to put that in slightly different words. I try not to read when I write. I just normally just write, but I'm a heavy editor. I mean, I edit way more than I write. So this book was edited after I finished the book. We took another year to edit it, and Houghton actually sent it back 7 times, not because they thought it needed more editing, but they were just kind of obsessed with making it perfect. So they sent it back 7 times with 2 or 3 different editors. So they really did a thorough job. But they worked me pretty hard, and the final, you know, the final product came out of a massive amount of editing. So
that's kind of a fun process, isn't it? I mean, just that sort of collaborative process. Once you get, you know, once an agent's involved, once an editor's involved, and just how the work transforms, I find really interesting and fun.
It really is. I mean, I've never worked with anybody before on a book. I've always been independent, and this time getting the editors involved, I learned a lot from them. I realized that I don't know as much about writing as I thought I did. You know, they call you up on certain things, and you can see that they're right. And it really was helpful to have the editors did a terrific job, especially early on when they, you know, did some kind of rearrangement of the book. I didn't take anything out, but I had to move some chapters around. And they helped me with that, because it's hard to see when you've got your head in it as much as writers do. You're so obsessed with what you want to say and what you think it should be, and then somebody else walks in and says, this is so obvious that you should switch these two chapters. And so they would come back to me, and they'd send it back and send it back. It all worked out. It was exciting. It was fun, and it was an incredible learning curve.
Mm. Well, I love your book, and I thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show, Terry.
Thank you, Barbara. I enjoyed talking with you.
Great. Thank you. That was Terry Messier. Her book is Fastest Things on Wings, Rescuing Hummingbirds in Hollywood. And if you're obsessed with hummingbirds as I am, this is your book. I neglected to ask her if she has a website, and I'm looking on her book, and I don't know. She must, right? So her last name is spelled Maseer. First name is Terry, Terry. You could look her up. And she does hummingbird rescue in L.A. We are at the end of our time again. It always goes so fast when you're having fun. If you want to know more about the show or events in the Southern California area, particularly Orange County, you can visit my website, penonfire.com. We have events coming up from July through November. And that's it for now. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. Come back next week. We'll be here.